Afternoon to you, wherever you may be. We're back live. This is Bruce Ash along with co-host Eb Wilkinson welcoming you to this special Super Bowl Brexit and pre-acquittal, pre-Iowa caucus weekend edition of Inside Track. Wow, what a week. The president is likely acquitted. Super Bowl 54, a pro basketball legend dies in a horrific crash along with his daughter and seven others. Wuhan virus expanded and China travel greatly curtailed. A new Mideast plan introduced and Palestinians immediately rejected. Iowa caucus finally here and votes are starting. Bernie surging and the Dems trying to change the rules to cheat him of another nomination. Wow. Look, I very much appreciate and hope all of you will support each of our Inside Track sponsors, Eb Wilkinson and his partner Gary Imus at Imus Wilkinson Asset Management, Jamie and Gary Kipper at Tucson Iron and Metal Surplus, and the folks at Corazon Cabinets, Joy, Jennifer, and David. Each has been with Inside Track from the start. They're great local companies you should do business with, and I really do mean what I say. I do business with each of them. Speaking of great local companies you should do business with, Corazon Cabinets is your locally owned source for wholesale, one-stop, high-quality kitchen, bath, and office cabinets, as well as design services. Do you have a home improvement project planned for the new year? Corazon sells quality J&K, Yorktown, and Conestoga cabinets and offers a wealth of design resources for your home. Call Corazon Cabinets and schedule a visit to the showroom. Call 488-2266. Let Jennifer or Joy know you heard this ad with Bruce on Inside Track and get an additional 5% discount on their already low wholesale prices. Hey, before we get the shindig going, we're going to hear about a great local Tucson tradition, Reunion de El Fuerte. This is at Fort Lowell Park, and Frank Flash is here from the Old Fort Lowell Neighborhood Association. And you know, Frank, I've lived here all my life. I guess this reunion at Fort Lowell Park and in the Old Fort Lowell neighborhood has been going on for 40 years. Boy, that's an incredible tradition for Tucson, isn't it?
Yeah, it sure is, Bruce. Thanks for having me. Yeah, like you said, it's been going on for the last 40 years. It was started by the Old Fort Lowell Neighborhood Association back then, and it continues to be a mainstay of the Neighborhood Association. Essentially, it's a it's a walking, self-guided walking tour of the neighborhood, including Fort Lowell Park, going west to the San Pedro Chapel. We'll have a lot of different activities going on. Specifically in the park, we're going to have the 4th Regiment Cavalry, Memorial Cavalry Group from Fort Huachuca doing their drills. And then we're going to have what we call a vintage baseball game. This is basically...
This is the old school. It's essentially the same game, but a very primitive game. Now, are they going to be in the old-time uniforms?
They're going to be in the old-time uniforms, and we're going to have, for everybody that shows up, we're going to have the set of rules so they can look at the rules and understand what the rules are and what the nomenclature was back then.
I think there was 4 strikes in those days.
I believe so. And it was always considered a friendly match, to Major League today.
Yeah,
so
it'll
be a lot of fun. But then if you spend some time in the park, you can cross over at Craycroft at the Hawk Crossing into the Atkins property, where we'll have food trucks, and then we'll have the...
That's a whole big wide area that's kind of wide open.
Right, and we'll have it designated as a specific area where you can walk so you can get to the food trucks, but also you can see some of the Native American Indians that are going to be there, or representatives of the Native American Indians. I think, I can't remember which group it is, but it's one of the groups that's indigenous to the Tucson area, and they're going to be putting on various chants and different songs that go with the Indian culture there.
Mariachis?
So mariachis will be down the street, walking up and down the street, and then we've got over at the San Pedro Chapel, we've got a presentation by Dave Buckley, all about the history of mariachis here in Fort Lowell. So it should be an exciting day. And, oh, by the way, when we say a self-guided tour, Fort Lowell Road between Craycroft and Beverly will be closed so that you can walk along the road and go and see some of the historic houses in the neighborhood. And to help you, there'll be docents along the way with history of the area, and then they'll answer any questions that you might have while you're going along.
This is really, and it's free.
It's all free, and it goes on from 12 noon to 4 o'clock. So there's a lot of activities. You might not get to all of them this time. So that means you need to come back in year 41 to see them again.
Yeah, and you know, Old Fort Lowell is one of those streets. I don't think any work's been done on it since the fort was there active in the 1880s.
Yeah.
And a few years ago, Mayor Rothschild and I were talking, and this is when that bond was going forth, and they were doing all kinds of road repairs all over Tucson. And I said, Mayor, I want to talk to you about Old Fort Lowell Road. And he thought I was going to like get on his case about how crappy the road was. I said, don't do anything to Old Fort Lowell Road. And you know from being on it, they haven't done a thing almost. I mean, there's some potholes there the size of manhole covers.
There are some people in the neighborhood who would suggest that the road should be torn up and turned into a dirt path to be more historic.
I'm all for that. I tell you.
Just leave it alone. It'll get there.
It will eventually get there. That's true.
But this is, you know, this is one of those streets. And when you're traveling through Tucson, for those of you who haven't lived here that long, and maybe, you know, you're up in the Northwest or on the Far East, I mean, this really feels as though you're in Tucson, you know, from the 20s or 30s almost, because just the feel of the street. And even when I didn't live in the neighborhood, I would pass through it every day just purposefully because I wanted to get that feel every morning when I came, when I went to work and when I came home at night.
Well, you and 6,000 other people a day go through the neighborhood. So it's well-traveled, and we hope everybody who comes out on Fort Lowell Day has a good time and is willing to come back and see some more.
And there's some other music as well, regimental band music.
Yep, there'll be regimental band music in the park. They'll be right adjacent to the museum. The museum will be open. And for those who haven't gone to that museum, although it's a small museum, it's got a really good history of the cavalry being in the last, so I believe it was the last fort built for the Apache Wars. And it's got a whole history about the Apache Wars in there. And you'll find it really interesting. And you don't have to read a lot because there's a lot of photographs.
Well, that's good. A lot of pictures. That's good.
That helps us Marines.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for coming. And in full disclosure, I'm a member of the Old Fort Lowell Neighborhood Association. And I really wanted to be on this and enjoy the kind of work that's being done by the association. And Frank's a big part of it, and so is his wife. Thanks to you guys. This is really great community work. And perhaps we'll come back at another time and talk about the Live at Home program, because I think that is a really specifically unique thing that a neighborhood association in Tucson, Arizona is doing for people who are aging and living in place.
Well, thank you. And the person at half for that is my wife, Kate.
I know. And she has a lovely accent as well, which makes it even nicer. So, Frank, thanks for coming on the show today. And I look forward to seeing you next week. And maybe you'll call in next week as we get going. So, John, let's go ahead and take our first break. And when we come back, we'll welcome NRA Vice President Willis Lee. You're listening to Inside Track. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Inside Track. Thanks for tuning in. Our first guest today is NRA Vice President Willis Lee. We're going to get caught up on National Rifle Association. Lieutenant Colonel retired Willis Lee is second vice president of the NRA. A member of the board of directors, Willis manages several programs and serves on 8 NRA committees, including as chairman of the Outreach, Military, and Veterans Affairs and Education and Training Committees. He's a life member of the NRA, Second Amendment Foundation recipient, and of their 2017 Defender of Liberty Award and Gun Owners of America. Willis Lee is president of the Conservative Federation of Republican Assemblies. Colonel Lee is a member of the American Conservative Union Foundation Board and is a member of the Council for National Policy. He's a former RNC member and GOP state chairman, where he, along with me and a few other members, were part of the Troublemakers Group. Willis?
That we were. Hi, Bruce. Hi, Eb.
Hey, Willis. How are you?
Eb is here with us. And we're looking forward. Let's dive right into a big Second Amendment issue, which is front and center, and that's red flag laws. I want to read something that actually came from your Facebook page, talking about a Colorado woman who tried to take out an extreme risk protection order against a police officer who shot and killed her son in 2017. And she's now facing felony perjury charge and has a warrant out for her arrest. This publication says, we first told you about Susan Holmes a few weeks ago when she filed the application to declare Corporal Philip Morris a risk to himself or others. Holmes declared on her application that she and Morris had children together, which isn't true. Instead, it was Morris and another officer who shot her son, Jeremy, 3 years ago in an incident described as suicide by cop. This is sort of, maybe it's an extreme example, but this is an example of what potentially the kind of chaos and really lack of due process that could occur under red flag laws, don't you think?
It's already occurring, and I'll tell you, Bruce, you're exactly right, and at least in this case, there's some type of means of rectifying this situation with this possible felony charge. The danger across the states with these red flag laws, not a one of which has met the standard for due process that would cause, as an example, for the NRA to ever support any of these heinous kind of laws, is this example here, but also in Maryland, where the firearms owner was actually killed in his home when the police raided his house at 3 a.m. to take it. It puts law enforcement in a very dangerous position of having to enforce these laws, and obviously all gun owners in a situation where they may be falsely charged.
So, red flag laws, there may even be something heard here in Arizona. How do you stand up against it? I understand that even the governor, up until recently, and he may still be thinking about proposing some sort of red flag laws here in Arizona. How do you defend against that? What needs to happen?
Well, some of it's the rationale. The point is that murder is already against the law. Felony possession of firearms is already against the law. And if one, as an example, even has a TRO, a temporary restraining order, there's already legal ramifications for those. There's not a need for another red flag law except as a political maneuver. But if we're going to have them, the easiest way to rectify this entire situation, and Bruce, you and I are quite versed in this with our Republican Party background, you have to win elections. And you have to win elections at every level, from the school board all the way up to the presidential election. And that's essential.
Yeah, you're right. So there's a bill, H.R. 5289, the Home Defense and Competitive Shooting Act, introduced by Representative Roger Marshall, Republican of Kansas. This is sort of a big deal, isn't it? According to a release by Representative Marshall, the legislation removes certain rifles from the provisions under the National Firearms Act, specifically rifles with barrels shorter than 16 inches. What are the benefits stemming from this modification, do you think, that are going to help all of us gun owners across America?
Well, here's the thing, not just for firearms owners, but anyone who supports the Second Amendment and freedom in America. The NFA is outdated. It was brought in at a time that's totally changed in America. It's unnecessary. It should be repealed, the entire NFA. What this bill does, however, is at least chip away at some of that. And that's this ludicrous law that says you can't have a rifle or a firearm that, in this case, they were targeting rifles and shotguns that have 16-inch or less barrels. The advantage for any type of home defense or firearms owner is a 16-inch or shorter barrel is just easier to maneuver around your home rather than the, by law, 16-inch or longer barrels when you're dealing in closed, confined spaces. So it's a huge bill just in terms of safety and protection of our families. But more important to me is it helps chip away at the NFA, which should be absolutely repealed.
So right now, I think you're at the Great American Outdoor Show. What's going on there?
Oh, let me tell you, this has been a joy. I am at the Great American Outdoor Show. NRA picked up this show, which has been a staple in Pennsylvania, in the Hershey-Harrisburg region for years. NRA picked it up about 7 years ago, and it is a remake. It's going great guns. We expect 200,000 people to attend this outdoor show in the next 9 days that we're here. As a boon to the local economy in the years, 7 years now, seventh year that NRA's had it, over $500 million into the local economy. And it is the largest in the world hunting, fishing, and outdoor show. It's just great fun. And these are all our people. These are salt of the earth. This is a fun show.
Even though it's 75 or 76 degrees in Tucson today, boy, that sounds like a place I'd much rather be.
Yes.
Yeah, but I both agree on
absolutely.
That. Absolutely. Yeah. Hey.
is a bucket list item. You guys are going to have to come someday. It runs for 9 days. You can pick. Some days are snowy. Some days are nice. But regardless, when you're inside the venue, it's all fun.
We'll do a live remote.
Hey, Willis, we have a caller, Kevin, with a question and a comment on red flag. Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, I see these red flag laws in the macrocosm of what's happened to President Trump with this FISA Act. When you start talking about lack of due process, the people that are in positions of power in government utilize the laws and twist them and try to stay just, anything that they can do to get their way, all right, without due process is exactly what went on with this Strzok and Lisa Page and all of these people. They went after the President of the United States.
Okay. Sure, but Kevin, what's your question?
And they'll do the same thing with us with these red flag laws, so we can't allow these things to pass.
Hey, Kevin, thanks very much. Willis, what do you say about that?
I absolutely agree with Kevin, but the key to not allowing them to pass is, Kevin, you got to join this. Let's get out there and win some elections. We have to turn legislatures, we have to turn executives around so that they are supportive. And I'm not saying Republican or Democrat. Right now it's mostly all the way Republican. But they've got to be supportive of not just what we call our Second Amendment rights, but of our civil rights.
So you're talking about elections, Bloomberg. Every town for gun safety, the Bloomberg-created gun control group announced Monday that it plans on spending $60 million in the 2020 elections in a bid to do the United States as a whole what the group did in Virginia in 2019, give Democrats complete control of the executive and legislative branches of government. This guy is running for president as well. He spent $100 million in the last quarter strictly criticizing the president. There's huge money that's going up against individual freedoms here in this country in this election.
Yeah, you know, because of where I am right now and as the vice president of NRA, I am pretty much have a focus on that $60 million with every town and the mom's demand and things like that. But we can't take our eye off. There's millions of more dollars Bloomberg is soaking into all of the issues, from abortion to climate to everything else that the socialists want to pass now. So we in the political world can't take our eye off the major impact Bloomberg's had. The $60 million is just indicative of what he's trying to do.
Hey, Willis, this is Eb. You were talking about NRA and civil rights. Gun control is racist, speaking of civil rights. Take a look at Martin Luther King. He was denied a carry permit because he was black.
Yeah, you guys have probably seen my hashtag, and I actually borrowed it from a friend. It's hashtag all gun control is racist. And that's how it began. That's how it's been codified in America. And that's what the Democrats, and it is the Democrats who continue to push this. And as a racist party, they get away with it. But the bottom line is anytime, and I'll give you an example, anytime you want to raise taxes on firearm sales or ammunition sales, guys, you're not hurting me. I can afford it. But you are hurting all of the folks who can least afford it and most need to be able to defend themselves. I'll give you an example, another one, in South Chicago as an example,
yep,
where folks ought to be able to afford and have firearms to be able to defend themselves.
Or D.C.
Or D.C. Baltimore has just gone out of control. And the Democrats foster that, and yet they get the votes. And so far, the realization is all of this. Now we're seeing these attacks on the Jewish population. Gun control is racist. The Democrats know it. It's not about guns. It's about control.
And it's not just blacks. It's not just Jews. It's also women. It's also gays. I know a number of gay and lesbians that are now joining the NRA as well as the Pink Pistols and learning how to defend themselves. And I want that.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely, but I'll go further. It's all minorities, and it's just been that way in America. In New York in their early days, it was the Irish. In Hawaii in the early days, it was the Chinese and Filipinos. So it's always been a function of trying to keep minorities. In this case, they typically are folks that don't look like what
us.
We think is supposed to Americans look like, from having firearms to be able to defend themselves, or more important, to be able to defend themselves from tyranny. government tyranny.
So the left is also using the banking system to carry out its industry boycotts and bully firearms dealers and manufacturers, and in fact, also the NRA. What can be done to stop this sort of intimidation?
Well, thanks. We're going to see some of that done at the highest levels. And right now, the salient example is what's happened in the state of New York, where the governor went out and instructed banks and financial institutions and insurance institutions that they would suffer some type of penalty if, in fact, they did any business with the NRA specifically. But it was targeting the firearms industry as a whole. We, NRA, have challenged that, and it is so egregious to use the government to stop a nonprofit, in this case, from having their First Amendment rights that Arthur Miller and the ACLU have sided with the NRA in this case.
You steal my heart.
The courts. So for all of most folks aren't going to know Arthur Miller, but if anyone listening is a lawyer, they've all either read his book or studied his material in first year law. And he is a liberal. The ACLU, we all know about them. They both submitted amicus briefs on our part.
So basically, the left is doing a quid pro quo.
Quite an overreach, but that's how they do business, and we know that's how they do business. And most of what they've done with the president has just been a function of projection on their part.
Yeah.
This is how they do business, so they think that's how everybody does business.
So NRA board elections coming up, and specifically two locals to hear in Tucson, Southern Arizona, Judy White and Todd Rathner in the election. Judy is a first-time person running for the board, and Todd, this would be a re-election. I support these two. I think Eb supports these
Absolutely.
Two.
Absolutely.
And tell gun owners, life members, and people with the NRA who have some exemptions enabling them to vote, this is a big election, isn't it?
It's a huge election for the NRA and for the Second Amendment, because we lead on this issue, and you want to make sure you have the right board members on our board of directors. And here's the catch, and I support both Judy and Todd in this race, but here's where I'll go. We have one officer up for election. Charles Cotton is the first vice president. Absolute must, and he needs and deserves your vote. But when you get your ballot and it's in your official publication, pull that open and read through those bios, and I encourage everybody to vote for one, not more than three or five, and certainly don't exceed seven. Don't vote for the whole slate of 25 or 31, whatever it is.
That's very, very smart. That's very, very smart. That's exactly what I did.
Well, let's also include Bob Manziel from Bullhead City.
Oh, I didn't see him.
Yes.
Oh.
He's up for election as well.
Oh, I'm sorry I didn't see that.
Great guy, by the way.
The big news is, if you're an NRA member and you're a voting member, that's a life member, or you've been a member five consecutive years, you receive your ballot. We're all responsible American law-abiding citizens called on to make tough decisions. Well, this is a tough decision. There are a lot of great folks running for the board this year.
Yep.
But go ahead and do your research. If you got to Google people, do your research, narrow your choices down to three to five, and vote them to make sure that they're the ones that we get on the board.
Hey, we're up against it. Just real quickly, there's been a lot in the news about the NRA and the business that happened back last spring. Tell us about the strength of the NRA and what's going on moving forward.
Well, look, to follow all our legal things, go to NRALegalFacts.org, and that'll give a synopsis of that. But I'll tell you, our membership's held steady at 5 million. Our budget got passed at this last board meeting. We're ready for 2020. We're ready to support President Trump and to keep the Senate and win back the House. So this has been a great year, but having our membership and our members so strongly with us has been crucial. Don't watch the shiny ball. Pay attention to what's important, and that's winning the election for Trump and the U.S. Senate.
Willis, great having you on the show. We'll have you on several times before the election. Friends, this man is one of the strongest, greatest patriots you're ever going to meet, and he's the real deal with the NRA. John, let's go ahead and take our bottom of the hour break, and when we come back, we'll welcome political activist, lobbyist for conservative causes, Roman Bueller. You're listening to Inside Track. We'll be right back. We're happy to join you again. Welcome back. Roman Bueller is the National Director of the Madison Coalition, working to restore a balance of state and federal power. Roman Bueller is has served actually as Newt Gingrich's first committee counsel, and from 89 to 2003 and again in 2007 as elections counsel to the Committee on House Administration, handling election issues for House Republicans. Prior to his service in the House, Bueller worked as an attorney and political consultant in California. I have worked with Roman over the years, and most notably to protect voting rights for military personnel, creating an amendment to the rules of the Republican Party. I think that was in 2012, Roman, am I remembering right?
That's right, 2012.
Yeah, this is a guy who really does care. And Roman is working on some big issues right now, which are related to the left's plan for winning the presidency. And it's the wealth tax, which Democrat socialists like Bernie Sanders is pushing. He says billionaires shouldn't exist. And he stated that in a tweet after announcing his proposal. The wealth tax is supposed to decrease the disparity between the super rich and the working poor. Roman, is there any example where the wealth tax actually accomplishes eliminating this disparity that's occurred anywhere in the world?
Well, I have to tell you, I'm not an international tax expert, but what I have heard is that there are a number of countries that impose the wealth tax and basically got rid of it because it didn't produce the kind of revenue that they wanted. Money is too easily moved around. And so the biggest impact of wealth tax in European countries was to simply move wealth elsewhere. But I'm convinced that the left does not want the wealth tax because they want revenue. I think the left wants a wealth tax because they want to eliminate the political power of people who earn money. The left wants to destroy the entrepreneurial and the investor class in America. And a wealth tax is a perfect way to do that. And so this is a solution, and they're looking for a justification. And I think it's a much greater threat than people suspect, because the left has a plan to get there, and I don't think that the right has a plan to stop them.
So there's an economic study that a fellow by the name of Rob Magnus is doing that shows the supposed wealth gap theory on its own is a false narrative. I mean, he studied tax rates and tax laws, as well as the actual collections from the inception of the U.S. income tax in the teens, a century or so ago, all the way up through modern days. And really, there is no greater disparity that exists today than existed in 1918 or in 1948. I mean, it all follows in the same curve. And this is a very scholarly research that he's been doing. Like you say, they don't want the wealth. They want to create a wealth tax to really drive capital out of this country, because that's what's going to happen in the long run, isn't it?
Well, I think, you know, politics is about the exercise of power. And if you look at what has happened in government in the long run, if you step back from the trees and look at the forest, the left has been for 100 years trying to transfer power from people to an elite bureaucracy that will rule over everyone. And in Europe, most of the rules are made by bureaucrats who never have to face an election, and that is the dream of the left in this country. And you know, you're correct. The tax rates haven't really changed the allocation of wealth in this country. Doesn't mean that the left isn't still trying to accomplish that goal. I think some people on the left would say, well, the tax rates simply haven't been high enough, and we've been taxing income, not wealth. So just because they haven't been able to eliminate wealth in this country doesn't mean that they're not trying. But the goal is not some, you know, populist utopia. The goal is a society run by a bunch of unelected bureaucrats who think they're smarter than everybody else and can tell everybody else what to do. And, you know, the left used to be
describe themselves as Democratic. But today, I would argue that the correct name for the Democratic Party is now the Bureaucratic Party, because they're a party that consistently wants to transfer power from the people to unelected bureaucrats in Washington.
So this is the same group that wants to abolish the Senate filibuster. They want to pack the Supreme Court. They want to add between one and two new states in order to change the balance, because D.C. and Puerto Rico, for example, would be solidly Democrat. As I said, they want to pack the Supreme Court. But one of the reasons they want to pack the Supreme Court is to rig redistricting in states all across the country, and the Electoral College ultimately. You know, it's amazing. I hear so many people talking about abolishing the Electoral College. You know, they make jokes about it. Comedians talk about it. Personalities talk about it. They don't know anything about the Electoral College. And you know, all they say is, oh, it's a bunch of white guys who get together. I mean, this is crazy. And as you said, and this really, I think this is a thing that ought to scare the bejesus out of people. Use unelected bureaucrats to intimidate by regulatory edict. I mean, that's the game plan that these guys have, isn't it, Roman?
Well, you know, we have lived, most of us, in a world where political control shifts back and forth. You know, there was the Eisenhower era, the Kennedy-Johnson era, and then you had Jimmy Carter, the interlude, then Reagan and Bush, and then you had Clinton, and then you had second Bush, and then you had Obama, and power went back and forth. And we're used to that. But the left isn't happy with that system. And they, I believe, have developed a strategy so that the next time they win a majority in Washington, they are planning to do some of the things that you talk about. Eliminate the filibuster, pack the Supreme Court, get rid of the Electoral College, rig the election rules so that they can't lose. And, you know, their vision of the world they'd like to see is California, where the conservatives are liberal Democrats and the left are socialists. And what's scary is that they have a plan for doing that the next time they win an election. And if you look at American politics, the Democrats win control of Washington pretty reliably about once every 15 years. And we can win one election or two election or three elections in a row, but sooner or later, the pendulum is going to swing back. And what we limited advocates of limited government and free enterprise ought to be thinking about is not just how we win the next election. And we don't know, everybody's worried about that, and we're going to spend $3 or $4 billion on that this year. We ought to be worrying, what do we do when the left finally wins? You live on the beach, what are you going to do when there's a hurricane? You're a farmer, what are you going to do when there's a drought? Because you know that a drought is coming, and you know that a hurricane is coming, and we don't have a strategy for living through that. And we've got to figure out, I think in very basic terms, how we take power out of Washington and limit the abuse of power permanently before the left next gets control. Because if we don't, we're in for some very, very tough times. If the left succeeds in packing the court and rigging the election rules, we may not win another election for a generation, and that would be a catastrophe for the country.
Roman, this is Eb. How do we control and tie the hands of the unelected bureaucrats?
Well, if you look at our strategy, our governing strategy, and I've been around in politics now for, 50 years, our strategy has been pretty simple. It's elect conservatives and try to pass laws. And the problem with that strategy is it doesn't work. First of all, we've never had 60 votes in the Senate to pass any law that seriously limits government. And the second is, when the left wins their supermajorities, which they do about every 25 years, they wipe out all the laws we've passed. So we've got to come up with a new strategy. And the new strategy is the original strategy of the authors of our Constitution, who brought us the Bill of Rights to limit the abuse of power in government. And I would argue that just as Reagan proved you could elect a conservative president, Gingrich proved you could have a conservative leadership in Congress, we need a new group of leaders who understand that we need a new set of constitutional checks on the abuse of federal power. Example, a balanced budget amendment. Example, a requirement that regulations be approved by Congress. And we need to constitutionally prohibit Congress from changing the size of the court.
So how do we do that?
Well, we need to think bigger than we think now. We think now about how do we win a majority. We need to think about issues where two-thirds of the country is on our side and mobilize that two-thirds. And it turns out that 70% of the people are for a balanced budget amendment. By 2-to-1 majority, voters want to see regulations approved by Congress, not dictated by bureaucrats. And by 3-to-1 majority, voters don't want Congress to be able to change the size of the Supreme Court. So if you look at the history of constitutional reform, just the history of it, how it's happened in the past, there have been 12 amendments to the Constitution since 1900. And every time a simple change in the Constitution has been focused on by an overwhelming majority of voters, Congress has proposed the amendment. That's how women's rights, the women's right to vote happened. That's how the 18-year-old vote happened. That's how prohibition was imposed and how it was repealed. That's how presidential term limits was imposed. So I would argue that if we go out and we build grassroots support, both in the public and among the states, for these amendments, which are basically checks and balances on the abuse of power, that we can achieve a breakthrough. Probably once we get the first one done, the second one will be easier. And so, I would argue that the amendment that is most urgently needed right now for the future of our country is an amendment to make sure that the left-wing plans to expand the size of and pack the Supreme Court can't be carried out. And so there's now a bipartisan group of people, actually led by a former Democratic Attorney General of Virginia, that are supporting a constitutional amendment which says very simply, the Supreme Court of the United States shall be composed of 9 justices, which means Congress can't manipulate the size of the court. And if we can build enough support to make that amendment happen this year or next, then I think it alerts people to the possibility that we can do more. And I would argue the second amendment that we probably ought to focus on is one that I've been working on for several years called the Regulation Freedom Amendment, which has been endorsed by the Republican National Committee with the approval of the White House. And that simply says that major new federal regulations have to be approved by Congress. We can get those two amendments done, then the toughest one is probably a balanced budget amendment.
And Ramon, you're working right now with members of the Arizona legislature with respect to some of those regulatory issues, aren't you?
That's right. Absolutely. Mark Fincham, Representative Mark Fincham, carried a resolution recently in Arizona, which passed, which urged Congress to propose the Regulation Freedom Amendment. And Senator Vince Leach is also working to help us to get something done in a similar way in the Senate. So this is an important issue to ask Arizona politicians about. Do you favor a requirement that major regulations be approved by Congress? Or do you want the unelected bureaucrats in Washington to keep their power?
And I know you've had some success. How many states have passed similar regulation curtailment resolutions?
So there are now 29 state legislative chambers in 18 states which have passed resolutions that urge Congress to propose this Regulation Freedom Amendment. And we think that in 2020, voters all over the country ought to be asking their elected officials, again, do you support this amendment? Do you think regulations ought to be approved by Congress? Or do you think the bureaucrats ought to keep their power?
So Ramon, when you look at an election map, you know, and when we've all seen them on our TV screens, where it's almost all red except for the two coasts, right? Why is it?
And just portions of the two coasts.
Yeah. So why is it that a regulation amendment, everybody hates regulations. I mean, and everybody knows how dangerous they are. Everybody in this country, even maybe some of the idiots in California, although they probably wouldn't admit it. But why isn't it that it's not just 18 states, but more like the 40 or 42 states that reliably are red states around the country?
Well, I think I look at it by legislative chamber. There are 99 legislative chambers in the 50 states. Of those, right now, 30 30 states and 61 legislative chambers have Republican majorities. And I think the real question is why we only have 29 of the 61 legislative chambers. And part of that is because it takes energy and resources and volunteer time to get legislators interested in issues that aren't on the front page of the New York Times and the Washington Post and the networks. So getting the issue on the agenda it takes time. I think the Democratic Party, most Democrats haven't because the Democrats have not been labeled as the bureaucratic party. I don't think enough Democrats are feeling the pressure. Basically, if people understood that the governing principle of most Democrats in Washington is to hand power to bureaucrats and let them rule by decree, I think there'd be a mini revolution. But we haven't driven that message home. So I think the answer is we've got to alert more people that here is a huge issue. It's that is behind all of the left's attempts to federalize healthcare, to federalize education, to federalize control over a lot of small businesses. Behind each of those issues is this underlying premise that unelected bureaucrats can rule by decree. And if we get people to understand that, I think the mood of the country, particularly in the swing districts that will determine control of the Senate and the House, could change, and it could change dramatically.
So the president states, and I'm not going to challenge him on his math, that for every one new regulation that's been adopted since he became president, 8 regulations have been eliminated. Would you generally concur that the president almost single-handedly, and with the help of Congress in some cases, has eliminated a significant amount of regulation?
Well, we have the lowest unemployment rates in generations. And the reason for that is the tax and regulatory policies of this administration. There is no greater advertisement for a free market, deregulatory economy than the actions of what this administration has done on regulatory policy. But the problem is that all of these things are done by executive order. They can all be undone by the next time a left-leaning president is elected. And if there's one thing that's inevitable in American politics, is that politics will shift back and forth. So what we have to do is we have to preserve the regulatory reforms that this administration has made. And this isn't about whether regulation A, B, or C is good. This is about whether regulations should be imposed by executive branch decree or whether there should be consent of elected officials. And there's no single regulation that galvanizes the American people. But I think if people understood that there's a fundamental choice in American governance to be made between a style that basically the president appoints regulators and the regulators issue edicts, and then you have to do what you're told, regardless of whether anybody ever voted for those rules. If that's your model of governance, you can, you know, vote for a left-wing candidate for president and be very happy. But if you think that governance ought to be governance, you know, by consent of the governed, that regulations, then you ought to be voting for people who support the Regulation Freedom Amendment. And we don't, the average person doesn't see that issue, and the average politician doesn't feel any pressure yet. But I think in this election year, they could. And this issue, properly developed by grassroots activists like people who are listening to this radio program, could actually make a difference to who wins some key races in Arizona.
So that's basically what your Heartland Institute is doing overall. You're just targeting it right now to this.
Well, Madison, Roman's also with Heartland.
Yeah.
That's what the Madison Coalition's all about.
Right, my friends at Heartland are very focused on regulation as well. But the organization that I lead is called the Madison Coalition. And if you're interested, you can go to our website at madisoncoalition.us and see all the things we're doing. But it's pretty simple, you know. If you think bureaucrats ought to run the country, then you don't need to do anything because that's what's going on. That's where we're headed. But if you think the people ought to be in charge, and regulations ought to be approved by Congress, then maybe you go to visit our website, madisoncoalition.org, and get in touch with us and see how you can help make more political leaders aware of this issue and get them on our side.
Ramon, the other, we got about 2.5 minutes left before we got to close the conversation today. The other part of this is a second term for Donald Trump to bring more federal judges who are conservatives into our court system. Is that a fair statement to make?
Well, the greatest domestic policy achievement of this administration has been to appoint judges who believe in interpreting the Constitution, not distorting it. And what I worry about is that all of the work that has been done over the last 20 years to appoint constitutionalist judges could be undone if the wrong team ends up in control in Washington. But it's not just going to be because the wrong team appoints different judges. And of course, it's important to elect President Trump because of the judicial appointments. But the bigger danger is that if the left wins, they're going to try to pass a law which would expand the size of the Supreme Court and undo all of the work that we've done over the last 20 years. And that is something that people ought to be concerned about.
Well, there's no question that the court packing is a huge issue, and all the various distortions that come from that. So, if anybody's interested in really approaching the issue on regulations and the bureaucracy, talk to Mark Fincham. He's your representative up in LD11. Vince Leach is your senator in LD11 as well. These are two men committed to it. If you're trying to do something and look at this on a national level, Ramon Bueller with the Madison Coalition, www.madisoncoalition.org. They're doing great work. I've had a long relationship with Ramon, and I can tell you that he is truly somebody who cares about this country. And folks, we've got to close out now. I hope you'll continue to support our great advertisers. Imus Wilkinson Asset Management, Tucson Iron and Metal Retail, and Corazon Cabinets. Each of these companies are well-run local family businesses. Their profits all stay in Tucson to help our community. Now, I know each of these owners. They love our hometown. They deserve our support. Until next week for Inside Track,
Eb Wilkinson
and Bruce Ash, wishing you a very pleasant good afternoon.